all glories to the Samadha devotees, all glories to the Samadha devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga, glories to Srila Prabhupada, Grantharaj, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki, Gaur, Premanandi, Hari Hari Bo. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Purna Maharaj is here, but I was just told he was seen going on a walk with Jayadvaita Maharaj. So whether Maharaj will suddenly grace us with his appearance in this class, I don't know. I don't know where they went. But anyway, we were finishing up the material for chapter 13 of Canto 1 of Srimad Bhagavatam. And if I remember correctly, I think we were on page 10. Yes? Yeah, page 10. And at the end of the last class, Maharaj and I got into a discussion about the point one, which is carried over from the previous page. So it's at the top of page 10. And there were points 2 and 3. These are points to question number 19, which is a question asked by Yudhisthira initially to Sanjaya. Yudhisthira, after doing his morning duties, came to see that Vidura, Dhritarashtra, and Dhritarashtra's wife Gandhari had suddenly disappeared from Hastinapur. And as we saw, as a being himself a most saintly person, he became worried that they had left because of some fault of his. Although actually there was certainly no fault. It was Dhritarashtra who had for years, together with Duryodhana and others, plotted against the Pandavas, and those plots resulted in repeated attempts against the Pandavas' lives, so these aggressions, and finally the Kurukshetra War. So actually, all of this was responsibility was really on Dhritarashtra's shoulders. And yet, Maharaj Yudhisthira was so kind that he had given a place to Dhritarashtra out of his loving sentiment for him in the royal household, which was now ruled by the Pandavas. An honored place. And Dhritarashtra had actually become attached. He was really had no function any longer, just living there, enjoying the facilities. And then Vidura returned, having himself become an ocean of transcendental knowledge, and acted as sadhu for his brother, as we saw, using very cutting words to cut him free of, to cut Dhritarashtra free of his material attachment. And so this was the result, that Dhritarashtra, after so long just kind of living in the lap of luxury, suddenly became, his kshatriya determination returned to him, and now it was determination to achieve liberation. Prabhupada pointed out in a purport we read that he had already wasted 80% of his life. So this is actually miraculous that at such a late stage in his life, having wasted so much of his time, by the grace of his brother Vidura, Dhritarashtra was able to at least achieve impersonal liberation. That was, we read, was a cause of Vidura's grief after the departure of his brother, that he could not make him into a pure devotee, but that was the toll of his offenses. He committed so much Vaishnava aparad that Krishna just wouldn't permit that much spirituality to manifest in his character, that he could be a pure devotee, but at least he achieved liberation. So anyway, when Yudhisthira came to know that Vidura, Dhritarashtra and Gandhari had disappeared, suddenly vacated Hastinapur, he thought it was his fault. He thought that I must have neglected them, I must have, while they were staying here, shown some ill attitudes towards Dhritarashtra because of remembering his offenses of the past or whatever, what I considered to be his offenses of the past. So that actually showed his saintly character, that he took the fault upon himself, although he was faultless. So he asked Sanjaya what happened, and Sanjaya was unable to answer. Then Narada Muni appeared, and Yudhisthira put the same question before Narada Muni: what happened to my uncles and my aunt? And so Narada Muni gave Yudhisthira spiritual instruction, and the significance, this is what we were discussing, the significance of Narada's reply, which was in three parts, and we covered the first part. So that's the second part is, Narada told Maharaj Yudhisthira that one should look to the mission of the Lord, which is to remove the harassment of the devotees and the general mass of people by the demoniac. And in this way, the Lord reclaims the fallen souls. And so seeing the purpose of the Lord, one should not be disturbed by the affairs of so-called happiness and distress. So this is, we find this lesson given in verses 48 through 50 and the purports. And then the third point, the third aspect of Narada Muni's instructions are that although the purpose of practicing the sitting postures in yoga is to become free from the influence of the modes of nature, this freedom is most easily accomplished by engaging the senses in Krishna's service, wherein one can get free, completely free from the modes of nature. And this will occur when one practices devotional service without offending Vaishnavas, and when one associates with potent sadhus, and when one is pious and follows the footsteps of great Mahabhagavatas like Narada Muni. So this is the lesson of verses 51 through 60 and the purports. And again, this is was the difficulty that Maharaj Yudhisthira had in achieving pure devotional service, is that he had committed very many offenses against Vaishnavas. And that was the cause of Vidura's lamentation at the end, that he couldn't completely purify his brother, but at least he achieved liberation. So, now we come to the section we call Parishishtam, or the appendix. And there are points of interest here, Vinodikam, in the form of certain important verses in this chapter. So, actually tomorrow, we're going to be handing out the weekend essay question for those who are fully enrolled students. And there's going to be a whole page of introduction to that question. So, because we are putting now more stress on this, the essay questions, the weekly essay questions, and we're explaining in tomorrow's introduction to the essay question just what the fully enrolled students need to know for the examinations, for the Bhakti Vaibhava examinations. So that will become a regular part of this section. At the end of every study guide, the Vinodakam, the point of interest. Actually, the Vinodakam from now, from the outline to chapter 15 onward, will be simply dedicated to those points that you need to know, that you need to be prepared for in taking the examinations. And that includes these outstanding verses, as we shall now discuss, that in the Bhagavad Arka Marichi Malam, chapter 15, which is Bhaktivinoda, the Bhagavad Arka Marichi Malam is Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's analysis of the full text of the Srimad Bhagavatam. He's extracted the most essential verses from the Bhagavatam in terms of Sambandha Abhijaya Prayojana. So we look at this to get the important verses, and also we look at the verses that Srila Prabhupada, of course, are most often quoted in his writings and in his lectures from Srimad Bhagavatam. So in the Bhagavad Arka Marichi Malam, chapter 15, which is called the Analysis for Favorable Conditions of Bhakti, or Bhakti Anukulya Vichara, which is found in the Abhidhyaya division of the work. So in other words, this verse we're about to cite concerns Abhidhyaya, or the active process of devotional service. So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur cites this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 13. This is canto 1, chapter 13, verse 10, in which Maharaj Yudhisthira says to Vidura, "My Lord, devotees like your good self are verily holy places personified. Because you carry the personality of God within your heart, you turn all places into places of pilgrimage." And also, we see in the next section of the Vinodakam that this is one of this same verse is one of three important preaching verses from Srimad Bhagavatam that was often quoted by Srila Prabhupada. So we give the same verse, this time the Sanskrit, Brihad Vidha Bhagavatas Tirtha Bhuta Svayam Vibhul Tirtha Kurvanti Tirtani Svantastena Gadabrita. Same translation. "My Lord, devotees like your good self are verily holy places personified because you carry the personality of God within your heart. You turn all places into places of pilgrimage." This was Yudhisthira's glorification of Vidura when he appeared in the palace with the intention of preaching to his relatives, particularly to preach to deliver Dhritarashtra. And then another verse that Prabhupada would quote is from this chapter, verse 17, which we've titled, "Time Affects the Grihamedis." So, evam griheshu ashuktanam pramattanam tad ihaya vikramad avigyata kala parama dushtara. That insurmountable eternal time imperceptibly overcomes those who are too much attached to family affairs and are always engrossed in their thought. This is a verse by Sutta Goswami. So eternal time is imperceptible. This means you can't really notice it, notice its effect very easily day by day. I mean, every day we look into the mirror and we see the same face we saw yesterday. But imperceptibly that face is changing in time, you see. If we could have this, you know, what's called time-lapse photography effect in our consciousness, where you could suddenly jump ahead 10 years, then you'd see a change, or 20 years, you'd certainly, you see, if there was that sort of jump morning by morning, 20 years, you'd certainly see a big change in the way your face looked. But day by day, you don't see the change. Day by day, we don't notice time creeping up on us and taking away our attachments and our very life. So those who are considered grihamedis, the word grihamedi is distinguished from grihasta. The word Medha means intelligence. So one whose intelligence is 100% dedicated to household affairs and nothing else, in other words, he has no time in his life for any higher inquiry, any devotional service to the Lord, any thought of Krishna, any hearing and chanting, any association with devotees, any of that. He's just simply working, and bringing money home and enjoying family affairs. So for them, time is like a burglar. You know, there's this type of burglar. They call the cat burglar. Who's, as I read, is supposed to be a pretty psycho type of person. Because cat, but they have them, actually. I went to Nepal April and May of a year or two ago, and we went to the Gandaki and we got some Shalagram Shilas. It must have been 2 years ago. And so the jump off point for going up the Gandaki Valley is the second largest city in Nepal called Pokhara, which is a big tourist place, as is Kathmandu. But Pokhara has this beautiful lake. There's this lake, and you get the vista of the Himalayas, Annapurna, which is one of the highest peaks in the world. I think it's rated number 10, so you, in the early morning you see a nice vista of Annapurna, huge mountain, and other mountains in the background. So it's a beautiful place. One night at about 3:30 in the morning, or one early morning, so it was anyway about time to get up. So I was sleeping in the guest house, and so I just opened my eyes. It was 3:30. I glanced over the clock and I noticed, well, it's that time. And then I heard a kind of scratching sound. And so my head was in a position where I could just move my eyes over to the window, a window near me, without having to move my head. And I could see in the darkness, I was on the middle floor of the guest house, so there was one floor below. And so just hanging off the window, there was the shape of this man who was just dressed in short pants, and I could see his body was glistening. He had rubbed his body with oil. The reason for that is if you grab the guy, he can slip out of your grasp very easily. So his body was all oiled up, and he had a knife, and he was cutting through the screen of the window, the mosquito screen. He was cutting down the side, and his intention was to sneak into my room. And he was a cat burglar, in other words. That means silently, like cat. They come into your room without waking you up, and they steal your valuables, and then they sneak out. So, as some of you know, I never go anywhere without my own weapon. So I had my own flick knife, and I pulled it out from underneath my pillow, and I put it right in his face, and I said, "Okay, baby, what's your next move?" And then he just like a spider, down, and I saw him running over the, jumping over the wall and disappearing. But he had actually already burgled another guest's room and taken their camera and their money and... So this is imperceptible, you see, this is like time. Time like a cat burglar steals up on us without us noticing and eventually takes away our life. So time affects those whose medha is unaware. That's the meaning of griha medhi, griha, the medha, the intelligence, is totally absorbed in just day-to-day affairs. And so they're unable to notice. But those who are Krishna conscious, those who are practicing devotional service, even though they may be householders, They're keeping watch. I mean, this is intelligence. Just like if we just talk about intelligent household life or intelligent any kind of life, if you have anything given you under Krishna's care, like a home or any place to live, any property that you're using in Krishna's service, then to use it intelligently in Krishna's service means you should watch over it, just like a temple. Never mind Grihastha, brahmacharis are traditionally living in temples. So at night, you close the doors, you close the windows, you lock them, you put a... if you're really careful, you post a guard, because even a temple is target, as we well known in history here in Mayapur. A temple can be target of burglars, robbers, even once or twice, was it? In the history of Mayapur, an armed gang came to just openly plunder the place. So it's only intelligent to look out for that which Krishna has placed under your care in his service. If we're careless, if we just leave doors and windows open at night, then you deserve it. If you wake up the next morning and your place is totally stripped, I mean, whose fault was it if you were so foolish as to leave everything open? So anyone who's intelligent, they they're valuables given to them by Krishna, which is Lakshmi, which is meant for his service. They take good care of. They keep a watch out. So similarly, one who is Krishna conscious is observant of the time factor. And this is why Vidura returned as he did. Vidura had already become fully equipped in transcendental knowledge. He had taken sannyas. He was already a jivan mukta, a liberated soul, while living in the body. He had no reason personally to return to Hastinapur and again meet with his relatives. Actually, that's generally something a sannyasi will not do. But he did return out of loving concern, particularly for Dhritarashtra, which really shows the heart of a sadhu, because how had the Kauravas treated Vidura? You all remember. He had been driven out because he had dared warn Dhritarashtra, and through Dhritarashtra, Duryodhana, that your politics against the Pandavas is going to ruin you. You're committing offenses against the Lord's devotees, and this will not be good for you. And he actually told Dhritarashtra, this son of yours, Duryodhana, is quarrel personified. He's Kali personified. He's going to be the ruination of your dynasty. You should get rid of him. Yeah, he told you very bluntly. And of course, Dhritarashtra, he wouldn't do anything. And Duryodhana became very insulted, just like he began to breathe hotly, just like a snake that had been trampled upon. And then ordered that Vidura be driven out. So this is how they had treated Vidura, but Vidura nonetheless returned because he was remembering the time factor and its effect upon Dhritarashtra. He was concerned about Dhritarashtra's welfare. So he came back to preach to Dhritarashtra, and he indeed did liberate him. Then there's also, thirdly, this important verse, which we already covered, but repetition is important for learning, so it's again listed. This is called Jungle's Law, famous verse. Astani sahastanam apadani chatushpadam palguni tattva mahatam jivo jivasya jivanam jivo jivasya jivanam. We've all heard that. This verse is spoken by Narada Muni. And the context is very interesting, that he was instructing. This was when Yudhisthira failing to get an answer from Sanjaya what happened to Dhritarashtra, then Narada Muni appeared, so he asked Narada Muni. And in the course of answering that question, Narada Muni advised Yudhisthira, why should you lament? Why should you feel loss that Dhritarashtra, Vidura, and Gandhari have suddenly left in the night for Dhritarashtra and Gandhari's spiritual welfare? Because were they under your protection? Is that what you were thinking? Is that what you were thinking? Is that why you're lamenting that you had responsibility to protect them, to take care of them, and you feel that you have failed that responsibility? Is that why you're feeling sad? Well, I wish to inform you, Yudhisthira, that you yourself need protection. And then he cited this verse that those who are in the nature's law is that those who are devoid of hands are prey for those who have hands. Those devoid of legs are prey for the four-legged. The weak are the subsistence of the strong. And the general rule holds that one living being is food for another. So Narada Muni goes on to say that you are already yourself in the jaws of the serpent. Actually, in the Vedanta Sutra, the Lord is given one name. The Lord himself is given one name, the eater, because he eats everything and everyone. I don't know if I've mentioned this, but it's interesting that the Sanskrit vowels, there are 14 Sanskrit vowels. Of course, now I'm sounding like I'm a big Sanskrit scholar. I'm not, but I just happened to learn this. So Vagish Prabhu can... You can correct me if I'm wrong. But there are 14 Sanskrit vowels. And they're divided into male and female because typically the male vowels are short and the female vowels are long. That's why when names are given, initiation names are given, then generally the ladies will get names that end in long vowel sounds like A or E. Or O, like that, you hold it longer. Whereas the men devotees will get short, Krishna, Das, like that. Whereas the lady might be given the name Krishna, Devi Dasi. So anyway, they're divided like this. Seven are short and seven are long. So seven are male, seven are female. So the short vowels, the male vowels, go from A to O. And that's considered the beginning and the end. Because in Lakshmi Tantra, these letters, they have significance, their own significances. So O stands for Sankarshan, or Mahavishnu, who is the end of everything. Why? Because when he breathes in, then all universes enter his body. And this word O in that context is said to stand for Odana in Sanskrit, which means rice pudding. That the whole cosmic or all the universes become a big rice pudding, which is eaten by Lord Sankarshan and digested by him. You see, fully digested, it becomes one with him. That's what it means, that everything is merged into his body. And then when he breathes everything out, then everything is re-manifest. So I just pointed this out because in the Bible, I believe, I don't know if it's the Old Testament or New Testament, I forgot. I think it's maybe the Old Testament. But anyway, in a text, biblical text, which is originally written in the Greek language, so maybe it's the New Testament. I'm not sure. Maybe some of the Old Testament scriptures were also, the original Hebrew is lost and were rewritten. I think I read that we're actually now originally also in Greek only. So I'm not sure where it is. But there is a statement where God says, referring to the Greek alphabet, I am Alpha and Omega, which means I am beginning and end. I am A and O. which holds true in Sanskrit vowels, male vowels. A to O means beginning to end. So that's for those who are interested in these kind of things. You can note that. So that's the sense that that this verse is famous verse, Jivasya Jiva Jivanam. That's the context of the instruction that Narada is saying gently to Maharaj Yudhisthira. Who are you to think that you can protect Yudhisthira and Gandhari when you yourself are in need of protection? So actually he is warning him that just as now Dhritarashtra and Gandhari have left for their spiritual attainment, so you and your brothers will also soon leave. And we shall see that in just a couple chapters, that Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers will also similarly, as soon as they get news brought, conveyed by Arjuna, that Krishna and the Yadu dynasty have departed this world, then they have no more purpose, because they have descended simply to be part of Krishna's Leela, so they themselves also leave home for achieving perfection. So that is Narada's warning, that you too will soon have to leave. So I'll take the rest of the time to just go over, this is the at the end of the appendix, we have these excerpts from Prabhupada's purports in this chapter, which are interesting. These are not necessarily items that are of, you know, centrally focused on the theme of the verses in the chapter, but they're interesting of themselves. Interesting that Srila Prabhupada has pointed these things out. So in the purport to chapter, to verse 13, Srila Prabhupada writes that according to Niti Shastra or civic laws, one should not speak an unpalatable truth to cause distress to others. Distress comes upon us in its own way by the laws of nature, so one should not aggravate it by propaganda. And that is why Vidura, although knowing already that Krishna and the Yadu dynasty had left this world, already at this time, later the news will be brought to the Pandavas by Arjuna. But it's already known to Vidura, but he, even though he was asked extensively by Maharaj Yudhisthira, how are things in Dwarka, how's the Yadu dynasty, how is Lord Krishna, how is Lord Balaram, how is Subhadra, how is Maharaj Yugrasena, all these questions he asked. Following Niti, following this rule, Vidura, he just kind of stepped lightly around the question, didn't deal with it. So in the purport to verse 14, Srila Prabhupada writes that saintly persons like Vidura must be treated as well as a denizen from heaven. So think of a demigod coming down. A great demigod like Indra or Chandra, if they would come down on their vahana before us, how we would honor them. So similarly, a sadhu should be treated just as well. In those days, denizens of heavenly planets used to visit homes like that of Maharaj Yudhisthira. And sometimes persons like Arjuna and others used to visit higher planets. Narada is a spaceman. This is specifically about the arrival of Narada Muni. So Narada is a spaceman who can travel unrestrictedly, not only within the material universes, but also in the spiritual universes. Even Narada used to visit the palace of Maharaj Yudhisthira. And what to speak of other celestial demigods? It is only the spiritual culture of the people concerned that makes interplanetary travel possible, even in the present body. That's a very interesting point. That interplanetary travel actually depends upon spiritual culture. And so because in Kali Yuga there is no spiritual culture, therefore there is no real interplanetary travel. They've sent a rocket, they suppose, to the moon, but famously all they found there was dust And they came back with some rocks which were analyzed, and the scientists concluded, oh, these rocks are the same kind we have on Earth. So what? You know, and then that is, of course, actually given rise to much doubt that they really went to the moon. Not just among members of crazy sects like the Hare Krishna movement, but a good portion of the American population, Gallup polls have shown. I remember one Gallup poll where, you know, they usually ask a couple thousand people a certain question, and that's a sampling of the population, and then they get some idea what most of the people are thinking. So one Gallup poll came back with the results that half the respondents replied, I don't believe that man has gone to the moon. So that was quite surprising. And this is one of the reasons that all that money was spent and all they came back with was with rocks which they admitted could have been picked up in any desert on Earth. In fact, I think it was specifically mentioned, these are rocks similar to those found in Arizona. And Arizona and New Mexico are one of the regions where the United States has its secret bases, you know, for developing spacecraft. So, in fact, I remember reading in one James Bond movie of years and years ago. They showed James Bond, he's one of those chase scenes, you know. It was some old James Bond movie. In American government secret complex. And he bursts, you know, he's running and they're shooting and, you know, there's explosions. And then he bursts into one big, like, hangar, you know, big building. And he bursts into a scene where there's a whole moonscape set up. And you see the spaceship and the astronauts, and there's cameras filming, and the men are looking, what's this? And you see James Bond running, shooting his gun at the bad guys, and they run through this scene. So that was a kind of ironic comment that maybe the whole thing was produced on Earth. So even, you know, even Hollywood filmmakers even raised this question. Was it really done on the moon or on Earth? So in the purport to 25, chapter 13, Prabhupada writes, the word kripanasya jijivasaha are significant. There are two classes of men. One is called kripana, and the other is called the brahmana. The kripana, or the miserly man, has no estimation of his material body, which means he has no estimation of the value of the human body. But the brahmana has a true estimation of himself and the material body. The kripana, having a wrong estimation of his material body, wants to enjoy sense gratification with his utmost strength. And even in his old age, he wants to become a young man by medical treatment or otherwise. Prabhupada has made some interesting comments about that. It's getting a little late, and those comments are probably well known to you. If not, maybe they're not so appropriate for. We have young boys here and we have ladies here, so maybe they shouldn't be mentioned. Certain operations that old men have done to themselves. Anyway, moving on. Purport to text 27, Srila Prabhupada writes, there are three classes of transcendentalists, namely, one, the dhira, or the one who is not disturbed by being away from family association. Two, one in the renounced road of life, a sannyasi, by frustrated sentiment. And three, a sincere devotee of the Lord who awakens God consciousness by hearing and chanting and leaves home depending completely on the personality of Godhead who resides in his heart. The idea is that the renounced road of life, after a frustrated life of sentiment in the material world, may be the stepping stone on the path of self-realization, but real perfection on the path of liberation is attained when one is practiced to depend fully on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who lives in everyone's heart as Paramatma. One may live in the darkest jungle, alone, out of home, but a steadfast devotee knows very well that he is not alone. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is with him, and he can protect his sincere devotee in any awkward circumstance. One should therefore practice devotional service at home, hearing and chanting the holy name, quality, form, pastimes, entourage, etc., in association with pure devotees. And this practice will help one awaken God consciousness in proportion to one's sincerity of purpose. And in the purport to... Well, I don't know if we have time to go through all these. It's getting a bit late. But there is one I want to mention. I mean, if you've received this, you can study this yourself. But there is that I did particularly want to go over. That is the last one. No, the second to the last one, 54. In which Srila Prabhupada writes, even in the highest mode, the material mode of goodness, is also a cause of material bondage. And what to speak of the other qualities, namely passion and ignorance. Passion and ignorance increase the material propensities of hankering for material enjoyment, and a strong sense of lust provokes the accumulation of wealth and power. One who has conquered these two base mentalities and has raised himself to the platform of goodness, which is full of knowledge and morality, cannot also control the senses, namely the eyes, the tongue, the nose, the ear, and touch. That must be one who has not conquered these two base mentalities and has raised himself to the platform of goodness, which is full of knowledge and morality, cannot also control the senses, namely the eyes, the tongue, the nose, the ear, and touch. But one who has surrendered himself under the lotus feet of Lord Hari, as above mentioned, can transcend all influences of the modes of material nature and can be fixed in the service of the Lord. The bhakti yoga process, therefore, directly applies the senses to the loving service of the Lord. This prohibits the performer from engaging in material activities. This process of turning the senses from material attachment to the loving transcendental service of the Lord is called pratyahara. And the very process is called pranayama, ultimately ending in samadhi, or absorption in pleasing the Supreme Lord Hari by all means. So these terms are actually taken from the mystic yoga system. Pratyahara is a stage where the senses are withdrawn from their sense objects. The yogi enters trance, and no longer are his eyes seeing material objects or his ears hearing material objects, or any of his senses are in touch with material objects. And this is the result of pranayama, or breath control, because it's the pranas, the life airs, that control the senses. So he can withdraw the senses by first of all controlling the pranas. And this ultimately ends in samadhi, which Srila Prabhupada describes as absorption in pleasing the Supreme Lord Hari by all means. So I wrote a comment to this, a vritti, in other words. So in Anuchedya 278 of the Bhakti Sandarbha, Srila Jiva Goswami sheds light upon the stages of yoga that a bhakti yogi passes through as a natural result of the third smaranam, or remembrance, of the nine processes of devotional service to Lord Krishna. So smaranam develops in five stages. The first is samanyam, focusing the mind upon the deity. Next is dharana, withdrawing the mind from things other than the deity. Dharana is also a term used in the Ashtanga Yoga. It's one of the eightfold stages, which means concentration. So for Jiva Goswami, dharana means to withdraw the mind from things other than the deity. First of all, you focus the mind upon the deity, but then there are things other than the deity also. So the second stage is withdraw the mind from anything else except the deity. Then dhyana, which is also a term found in Ashtanga Yoga, which means meditation. So dhyana follows, which is the concentration of the mind upon the holy name, form, and pastimes of the deity. In other words, the deity is not simply a stone statue just standing there immobile. But the deity has his nectarian holy name. He has his beautiful transcendental form in which the mind, to which the mind becomes attached when the mind, when we actually see that form. And the deity has his pastimes, his eternal pastimes. The fourth stage is Dhruva Anusmriti, in which the devotee's mind flows interruptedly to the form of the deity. Queen Kunti, she speaks of this in her prayers. She's praying that her mind may flow like the Ganges, like our Mayapur Ganges is flowing down to Ganga Sagara, into the Pacific Ocean, the Bay of Bengal. So similarly, she prays that her mind may flow to the lotus feet of Krishna. So when the mind actually flows by itself to Krishna, this is the fourth stage of devotional meditation called Dhruva Anusmriti. The final stage, Samadhi, a term used by Jiva Goswami, and also that is the eighth anga of the yoga, mystic yoga process, is when the deity himself appears within the mind of the devotee. That, in other words, Krishna as Krishna. The deity is Krishna, but with our material eyes, we don't see the deity as Krishna. We, if we're honest, we see the deity as a kind of representation of Krishna. But when Krishna himself, the deity as Krishna himself, appears within the mind of the devotee, now that is to, because the mind of the devotee is now a suitable place for the Lord to make his appearance. As per, there's that verse in Bhagavatam's second canto that what is that? I've just forgotten it. Anyway, when the sound incarnation of the Lord enters into the ears, what is that? Yat Karna something. Anyway. Yeah. And enters the lotus of the heart, then Bhava Suroram, then the loving relationship of the Jiva and the Lord is established in that purified heart. So when the heart becomes, or the mind becomes lotus-like, like a lotus, in other words, pure, then the Lord makes his appearance there. And the relationship, the loving relationship with the devotee is enacted there. So the samadhi of the bhakti yogi is never to be compared to the asampragyata brahma samadhi that after many, many years of austerity and the complete suspension of physical and mental activity is only rarely achieved by astanga yogis. That asampragyata brahma samadhi means, of course, absorption in the impersonal Brahman. So there is no comparison between the two. So this citation from Jiva Goswami therefore indicates, shows us how Srila Prabhupada's explanation of yoga using the yoga terms is perfectly in order, perfectly correct. It is confirmed by Jiva Goswami. All right then, so we'll stop here. We've finished the study guide of chapter 13. Tomorrow we will hand out the weekend question for this chapter and begin the study of chapter 14. We will also have this, we'll also have tomorrow for you this nice chart, which you should have already received for the first 12 chapters. So there'll be a chart, similar chart for chapter 13, which, as you'll see in the introduction to tomorrow's essay question, we'll mention this chart too. This will be very important in the bhakti vaibhava examination, that you know the essence of this chart. That's why we're giving it to you. All right then, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I guess also tomorrow we will have time for questions. We might as well take questions before we start the next chapter. So we'll do that too. So thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.